Good morning. The relationship between the U.S. and Mexico has taken center stage in the presidential election. Today, we'll talk with the San Francisco-based Consul General of Mexico, Jimmy Jose Gonzalez. Look around Hawaii, and you'll see a lot of construction in progress. According to the UH Economic Research Organization, you may also be witnessing the industry's near peak. You heroes, Carl Bonham is back to talk details. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. It's billed as Hawaii's first music and multimedia academy, a 4-in-1 solar-powered mobile studio that brings professional capabilities within the reach of young students. And a wave energy test site in Kaneohe could move us all closer to energy independence.
It's Friday, September 30th. That's The Conversation. Now the news. Welcome to an Aloha Friday on The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. To my right, as always,
good morning,
Chris Vandercook. Good morning.
We're wondering what happens when the current building cycle comes to an end, yeah?
Who is the we?
You.
Well, maybe you too, and maybe you too.
That's right.
Now, if you walk around parts of Hawaii, it's clear that many neighborhoods are changing. One of the most pronounced areas is Honolulu, with buildings rising in the skyline that weren't there not that long ago. The construction industry has been doing well and still has a little headroom before an inevitable drop-off. That's the big message in the report today out from the UH Economic Research Organization. UHERO Director Carl Bonham is back to look at the details. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
This is not necessarily new news, but it validates a lot of what you've been saying for a while, that we've been coming to the point of almost peak, and that looking at a lot of the work that's been done on Oahu, that's going to be dropping off in the fairly near term.
It's not new news. If you talk to people in the industry for several years now, there's sort of been discussions and conversations about how long can this last. And you know, this report, the way I would characterize it is we're seeing more of a plateau than a peak. Basically, activity staying about the same as it was last year at about that level for the next several years before things start to drop off. Essentially, that's the new activity, new buildings, say, whether it's out at Ho'opili or some of the ongoing resort and non-residential building, just sort of taking the place of the things that you know are already in progress, right? So not a lot of new extra growth there. Just sort of continued fairly high level, and then an inevitable drop-off in activity. And we talk a fair bit about what are the forces that cause that.
So let's talk about some of those forces. I mean, clearly we are a finite place. I mean, that's one of them. But looking at some of the other issues is, you know, how much can we actually put in? What kind of infrastructure do we have? How much is it going to cost to bring things here to be able to do it?
Well, the cost item is so, you know, construction is a highly cyclical industry, and the forces that come to bear that tend to cause the cycles to go away, barring some kind of global recession or other major event, are usually related to cost. So one of the things that could slow or end the construction cycle is home prices getting too high and stifling demand, right? So if builders can't sell the product, they're not going to build it. The interesting thing about on that front, if in the report we talk about real home prices, so taking out the effect of overall inflation, and in this building cycle, from the bottom of the cycle back in 2011 till now, real home prices have only risen 20%. In a typical construction cycle, meaning the last two, say go back all the way to the 80s, home prices would have risen by 50%. Or even 70% in real terms. So home prices really haven't gone up that much yet. That's not likely to be the thing that kills off the cycle. On the other hand, construction costs have risen. So you've got, you know, do prices rise so much that people can't afford to buy, or do costs of construction rise so much that builders can't afford to build? And on that front, construction costs have risen more than in the typical cycle. And those will continue to rise, and home prices will continue to rise, and eventually the cycle will just naturally end, assuming, again, that we don't have some major event that changes things.
Looking at those costs, when we've been watching medium home prices accelerate, and you know, people being very concerned that now they're in roughly, you know, $740,000. What happens as they begin to approach 800, go over 800, hit a point of being the million? Paul Brubaker has been saying that for such a long time, that you know, the average cost is probably going to be somewhere around the million and not too many years from now. That is looking, you know, fairly possible, looking at some of the projections.
So our forecasts do not get us to $1 million in this cycle. If you were to go back, you know, I think when Paul said that, we were probably saying something fairly similar to it. If you would go back 4 or 5 years, you know, after the Great Recession, when home prices were falling and we were, you know, nearing the bottom of home prices, many of us were expecting a repeat of previous cycles where you have home prices double. And it just isn't happening. I just mentioned that home prices have only grown in real terms by 20%. Versus 50, 60, 70% in a typical cycle. And we think that there are a number of factors at play there. One is we still have an elevated level of foreclosures statewide, which is a little bit surprising. And that contributes to some supply. We've got tighter lending standards. While total income has gone up, household income really hasn't gone up. If you look at median household income, today on Oahu or on any of the islands, it's probably about the same level as it was in 2000.
And right? Many households are feeling that.
Point. Sure. Yeah. And so what you're seeing there is probably some of that is income inequality, where total income goes up, but the median doesn't. And so those factors seem to be are constraining that typical doubling of home prices. And plus, we don't have that bubble type housing market right now. We don't have this huge influx of outside money like we did in the Japanese bubble and like we did in the lead up to the Great Recession, where we had the subprime lending
bubble. Some people would say that's a good thing, is it?
Of course it is. Sure. No, absolutely. There's no reason to hope for home prices to double, I guess, if you're a homeowner. But still, it is a good thing for those prices to rise more slowly. But if construction costs continue to rise, then you know, eventually you can't build the unit that people are able to purchase.
Meanwhile, there is some building going on also on the neighbor islands, but not at the level that we saw not all that long ago, at least the last bubble.
The neighbor islands really went through a housing construction bubble along with the home price bubble that was associated with the subprime lending. And you know, a big inflow of money, particularly from California and the West Coast, and so there's no particular reason why you would expect that to repeat or want that to repeat. And so they have more inventory overhang. You are starting to see projects go forward. Alexander Baldwin's got some projects on Maui, and you are seeing some activity on the Hilo side and really across all the neighbor islands. But it's been slower to catch on, right? With Kaka'ako, that started three, four years ago on the neighbor islands. We're really just sort of starting to see this because of some of the inventory overhang associated with the overbuilding and then the people going back to the mainland.
Overhang and overbuilding, those terms.
Yeah. And so if you look at residential housing units that have been permitted, Oahu is getting close to the level we were at back in 2004-2005 of housing units actually permitted. And we haven't even begun the building. I mean, there have been permit applications for Ho'opili, but they haven't been issued yet. So we're getting back to levels that are not as high as they were in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, but they're as high as they have been in recent history. Neighbor Island is well below that level.
We got to go in just a second, but as you look at this, and clearly you've mentioned that the construction industry has been talking to itself a lot about this, no surprises here for them. And do you see the you know, real good sense of planning for this and being able to communicate that to a number of people who now are really happy because they've been involved with so many, what looks like to them, boom years?
What you don't want to be as a developer or as a builder, you don't want to be the last guy standing or the last woman standing and build the tower that then nobody wants to buy. And my sense from talking to a lot of people in the industry is that they're very aware of that. Someone will still build, you know, the last unit that maybe they shouldn't have. But I think it's less likely to be widespread, right? There certainly is no sense that, we're still rushing forward to get new projects off the ground, say, particularly on the luxury side, right?
Well, let's hope all that's also being communicated to all those employees. Thank you, Carl. We'll talk again.
Thank you.
Economics Professor Carl Bonham is the UH Economic Research Organization's Executive Director and one of its founding members.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:15, and coming up in the show, an opportunity for Hawaii students to work in a state-of-the-art mobile multimedia studio. But first, your quiz.
Umurokai, Ulanai, Umau, Ukaholabe, Ohavai.
We're moving from the current construction cycle to some historic construction for today's backyard quiz. Hawaii's rugged geography and highly varied climate zones have challenged some extremely ambitious public works projects. From H3 to the East Maui Irrigation System to the Hana Highway, it seems the imagination of builders know few bounds. One common attribute to many large Hawaii projects is the need to cross a substantial gulch or valley. The road to Hana is the most famous example with its 59 bridges. But on Hawaii Island, there is a historic bridge district that also contains an impressive number of bridges. And today, we're looking for its name. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And we'll bridge you to an HPR t-shirt if you're right.
Good morning. I'm Colin Moore from the Department of Political Science at the University of Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
We live in a multimedia age, one in which young students are often more thoroughly versed in the language of communication than their teachers. It's a world that has left print far behind, which is why the Manamele Project offers students the opportunity to work in media of their choice in a 4-in-1 mobile studio powered by solar energy. We asked Project Director Keola Nakanishi what the 4-in-1 refers to.
4-in-1, as far as the capabilities, we're talking about live event and studio, both mm-hmm. audio and video capabilities for each. Mm-hmm. But when we say a 4-in-1 studio for what, we're talking about for excellence, for going green, for community, and for Kiki. And so, you know, by excellence, we mean we have state-of-the-art equipment, Hawaii's finest musicians, engineers, and videographers behind them, assuring the quality of service that we offer to the community. And for going green, meaning we're solar powered, we are the truck that tows the trailer part of the mobile studio, runs on diesel or biodiesel fuel, and a lot of the products we create with students are talking about malama aina, malama kai, you know, taking care of our environment.
Sure. So,
and then for a community, you know, it's taking care of our local artists who have donated their time and talent. We refer to them as the Mana Mele Collective. There's over 200 artists, music, multimedia industry professionals that have donated their time and talent to CDs and concerts to raise awareness for the Hawaiian Charter Schools and Mana Maoli, our nonprofit. And so by providing service in the community, it gives them a little income, but they're doing it at a very affordable rate so that there's a margin of net proceeds to feed our programs.
Almost any of those 200 musicians might look at how they got where they got and somebody helped them.
Exactly.
Right.
And I think that's why they're so happy to give back, whether it's doing visits to the schools or providing real-world mentorships where students are mentoring with them as they provide services in the community, at an event or in the studio, creating whether it's a 30-second spot or a full-length film or album. You know, we're assuring quality through the pro artists at the helm, but the students are able to learn in a real-world setting as well.
You know, I remember being a college kid running around trying to make movies back in the day, and the biggest challenge was just getting anywhere near the gear that you needed.
Exactly.
You know, and you might have all the ideas in the world, but being able to set a camera on a tripod was a far away kind of a dream.
Exactly. A common thinking might be to start out a beginner who's just elementary or middle school age or even high school with some real basic level equipment and work your way up. Our thinking is beginning with the ends in mind. You know, don't let the canoe leave the beach until you can see the island that you're sailing to. And so we're showing them the top notch. Here's top quality. Mm-hmm. And so when they're part of a video like that Hawaii Aloha video we did, it's nearing 3 million views. And I think part of it is we have a lot of high-profile artists and Playing for Change that was supporting it. But a big part of it is its quality, and it's moving, and it's a compelling way to tell a story. You know, music and movies, you know, our Music Multimedia Academy is a compelling storytelling tool to empower their voices. You know, we say, tell your story from your place. A mobile studio allows you to do that. And by showing them state-of-the-art equipment and quality products from the start, it has them setting their sights high from the start.
Well, when all the obstacles, the technical obstacles are taken away, it's on you to do something good. If you can assume you're going to get something with high production values, suddenly you've got to really bring it, right? Because in a way, high quality equipment can expose flaws that much more readily.
I think part of what we're doing, we say, you know, teaching ABCs through music and multimedia, and by that we mean academics, business, and culture. And so by connecting them to mentors who are at the top of their game, whether we have, for example, we have curriculum maps and over 160 lessons that through the themes of music and multimedia teach language arts, math, science, and social studies, but also the Hawaiian language and culture, business and career, exploration or college and career readiness, depending on their age level. And by exposing them to, not just exposing, but connecting them to experts regarding the academic side, the college career readiness side, the cultural side, as well as the music and multimedia side, part of the logos and the tattoo designs on our mobile studio, one of them refers to the weaving of experts. And by them taking all this expertise, they weave it together to tell their own story. And so that's kind of the aim here. And we've have over 100 student-driven products created so far across our 11 partner schools, culture, community, and environment-based charter schools, ranging from the Ni'ihau schools and Kuaikini and Kanuikopono on Kauai, to our charter schools here on Oahu, Nanakuli, Waianae, Waimanalo, Ko'olaupoko area, as well as Halaukumana in town. And so across all these schools, some amazing products ranging from oral histories to celebrate and honor the wisdom of our kupuna before it's too late, to student originals, traditional songs and chants, audiobooks, PSAs ranging from anti-bullying and drugs to how to beat the standardized tests.
Mm-hmm.
The students come up with some pretty amazing things once you empower them to tell their story from their place.
Well, it sounds very student-driven. It sounds very mm-hmm. reflective of the mm-hmm. kind of ideas that mm-hmm. that young people think about,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Do they tell you that they feel more listened to than they have in other academic environments?
Definitely. We've only recently been found the time to kind of compile a lot of the feedback that has been coming, and the most important voice is the youth themselves. So we have a lot of awesome testimonials that we just started putting on our website, manamele.org, of the artists and our partners and the principals and the parents, and they have a lot of powerful things to say. But it's the voices of the youth and what they have to say that can be pretty mind-blowing. You know, I'll read it and it'll just hit me sometimes and kind of remind me that maybe this is worth doing, you know, because, you know, raising the funds year after year to sustain these programs has been more than challenging. And it's been 15 years of sustaining the programs, and it seems to be a lot less money out there, a lot more people going for that money, a lot more larger nonprofits who have, you know, full-time grant writers with that focus. And we're trying to slide that in on the side of running programs and putting on events and, you know, things like that. And when we do events, the students are really empowered to perform or be behind the soundboard or be behind the camera in a real-world setting. So, you know, while the events we have coming up are also fundraisers, they often don't raise a whole lot of funds, but it's still an invaluable experience because they're able to perform or apply their engineering and video skills in a real-world setting, and that's priceless.
Keola Nakanishi is the executive director of Mana Mauli, the nonprofit behind the Mana Mele project, which is described as Hawaii's first state-of-the-art 4-in-1 mobile studio powered by solar energy. The project includes a music and multimedia academy serving Hawaiian charter school youth. The solar-powered mobile studio is available to the public outside of school hours. And there's a benefit tonight at the Surfer Bar on Oahu's North Shore. Featuring Paula Fuga, Josh Tatofi, and Irie Love, you can find out more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
On one hand, arbitration agreements can help minimize unnecessary lawsuits. On the other, they could also hinder a fair outcome for those who feel wronged. For care home residents, signing an arbitration agreement could do more than disadvantage. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us now with a game changer for care home patients. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Did care home patients and their families really understand that when they were in a care home and being asked to sign a lot of paperwork, that they were potentially signing away their ability to sue a care home if it didn't perform properly?
John McDermott, the state's long-term care ombudsman, said, actually, there's a lot of concerns about that. Many folks, elderly people who are entering nursing homes or other long-term care facilities, suffering from dementia, maybe not really understanding the documents that they're about to sign. Of course, they're at a very vulnerable point of their life, but McDermott says they're basically being offered a take it or leave it option. Either you sign this arbitration agreement or you can go elsewhere.
That seems to be so, you know, greatly unfair, but it also seems to be just a very difficult situation when you're talking about someone who has potentially diminished mental capacity. How can they be asked to sign something like that?
Well, in fact, it was legal until just this week. the decision is coming from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. It's the first time they've made a big change to nursing home rules since 1991. And basically, they said, look, this rule is just fundamentally unfair. If there is a dispute that should arise between an elderly person who's at a care home facility, they should have the right to sue. And by the way, if an institution is not getting Medicare or Medicaid funding, they can set up their own deal. And even if they are, you could still agree to arbitration if both parties find that to be something amenable. But if you want to sue, you should fundamentally have that right. That's one reason our attorney general joined 14 other states and also the District of Columbia pushing for this rule change.
How have the care homes been responding to this?
They're not happy, as you can imagine. They lobbied against it pretty strongly. They said arbitration is less expensive, it's faster, and at least one official prior to the ruling warned that the cost of operating homes could grow considerably with this new rule implemented. By the way, it goes into effect at the end of November.
We always hear that if we do this, it's going to result in greater cost. But then again, having to keep the care homes on their toes as well might not be a bad thing. Certainly a great deal more fairness for those people involved, perhaps. So this goes into effect next month?
November 28th.
Oh, I'm already into October. Yes, thank you very much. All right, then. You have a good weekend, Chad. We'll talk to you again on Monday.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check. And after that look at international news now, a look at what's coming out of our news department next week. Happy to welcome back Bill Dorman, HPR's news director. So many of us were in motion in the last little while. Nice to be sitting across the desk from you.
Yeah, good to be back. Hi, Beth.
Hi there. So next week, we're still going to be talking about tourism.
Yeah, I know that you spoke yesterday with George Segetti, the head of the Hawaii Tourism Authority, about the big conference that's been in town. That four-day event wraps up later today. But it is such, in number one, such an important business to the state of Hawaii and all of us here. And also, it's really undergoing some interesting changes. And there are a lot of strands to this, a lot of angles. So early next week, some of that dust will have settled a little bit. And Wayne Yoshioka is going to take a look at some of the lingering highlights that come out of that. One question, and you covered this with George a bit yesterday, of how to localize the visitor experience. Everybody's looking at that. We'll hear some more about that. Also going to wrap in some what some of the takeaways are and how that target traveler really is shifting, not just in terms of identifying who it is, but what he or she is looking for coming to the state.
And while we're talking about visitors, we have a visiting artist with a very interesting perspective.
Yeah, something we don't really hear a lot about in Hawaii. Artist in residence at the Shangri-La, which is a great, great program, by the way, the Doris Duke Estate here in Honolulu, has brought a variety of voices to Hawaii that we might not otherwise get to hear. And that's the case with a man named Omar Ofendam. He's a Syrian-American rap artist, born in Saudi Arabia, grew up in the United States. That alone puts him in a relatively small group, but he brings a lot of layers. He uses Syrian history as part of his performances in an area that is really unfamiliar to a lot of Americans in terms of setting context, setting background, and Syria, country that has certainly been through refugee crises in the past, border crises. Its country's borders have been redrawn over time, hosted a number of different cultures at different points, and now more than 5 years of civil war. He'll be performing while he's here, running some workshops later this month, and Noe Tanigawa got a chance to sit down and talk with him, and really looking forward to this next week as well.
Sounds like something that a lot of people will be looking forward to hearing.
Yeah.
Also taking a look, though, sort of back over our shoulder. I mean, the year is quickly coming to a close, and we know that also means virtually the end of the sugar operation in Hawaii.
Sugar on Maui, yeah. Molly Solomon went over there, spent some time on Maui recently, and part of that, looking at the last commercial sugar operation, some of this is a look back at memories, some of this a look forward at what comes next, and a couple of pieces coming next week from Molly on that.
All good. We'll look forward to it, and glad to see you again.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. He joins us every week with a preview of what's coming out of our news department.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Whole Foods Market Hawaii, Ulupono Initiative, and Hawaii Pacific University.
This election cycle, perhaps more than others in the past, is featuring the relationship between U.S. and Mexico in the center stage, or on the center stage. As Americans have heard rhetoric about building a wall, arguments over immigration policy, trade policy, the rise of drug traffic, there also seems to be much about Mexico that Americans don't know. Today, the Consul General of Mexico from the San Francisco office, Jimmy Jose Gonzalez, is in Honolulu to share a little of that information with students at St. Andrew's Schools. This is his first visit to Hawaii in his official capacity. And while here, Consul General Gonzalez will be meeting with city, state, and congressional representatives. He joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Thank you for being here. We have heard so much over the last year, especially about Mexico in political terms and continuing to talk about that regarding trade, certainly lots about immigration, illegal immigration in particular, and so much that puts the U.S.-Mexico relationship in an adversarial position. But there are other things about Mexico that it seems Americans are unfamiliar with. What would you say those are?
Thank you very much. Yes, as you know, we cannot say anything about the general election, but the Mexican government will work with the next president of the United States. I mean, we have a very close relationship. We are friends. We are neighbors. We are allies. We are partners. And in this regard, what everything that has been said, what we're doing now is that we want to talk a lot about not a bilateral relationship, but we want to just tell the stories of what Latinos, Hispanics, Mexican Americans, and Mexicans do for this great country, for the United States. We want to tell those stories because there are a lot of contributions of these people to this fantastic country, the U.S.
Isn't the Latino population now about 11% of our general population?
Yeah, well, it's a variation depending on each state. In Hawaii, we have an important Latino population, most of them are Puerto Ricans, but we have a good number of Mexican Americans here, more than 40,000 Mexican Americans living in Hawaii. And some of those Mexican Americans actually are working with the military. So those are the kind of stories that we want to tell because they love this country. We feel very proud to be part of North America, and we are working together. And so that's what we want to say and tell.
When you talk about the stories of Mexico, certainly one of the big stories is the rise of the middle class.
Yes. For example, my generation is an after generation, and we grew up feeling very proud that to be part of North America as a U.S. So now we are enhancing, we are promoting by nationality. We are telling all our Mexican citizens that can become American citizens to do so. And there are a lot of U.S. citizens that could become also Mexican citizens, and we are also telling them to get their Mexican passports because here in Hawaii, you understand very well the plurality of many nationalities in one place, and that is what North America is also about. So we're promoting that we can have both passports in the legal framework of the U.S. and of Mexico. That is possible.
I want to ask you also about NAFTA. You mentioned being part of the NAFTA generation. If you know, this is as mutually beneficial as, for example, President Obama said not that long ago when he was in Mexico. But how do we look at this in a way that begins to shape the relationship a little differently. I mean, we're told that Mexico is our third largest trading partner in the U.S., and that doesn't seem to be something that people generally carry in their consciousness.
Yes, you're right. Mexico, for example, is the first international partner of 25 of the 50 states in the U.S. And NAFTA worked very well for both countries. A lot of 6 million jobs depend on NAFTA in the U.S. only. So it worked very well, but we gave for granted many other things that we shouldn't have. For example, all these messages, all these great contributions, all this new approach that we have as North America, as a region, and not only as a bilateral simple relationship. We together are more competitive. We are stronger if we work together. So NAFTA was great. It is great. Maybe there's some opportunities to review some things. But what NAFTA did is that we became closer to the U.S. in a cultural and in a more friendly approach. So what we have to do now is to tell those stories and to talk about it more, because all of those contributions, it seems that in some parts of this great country, they didn't, they just didn't weren't heard, or they didn't know them about them. So we have to work on that.
What specifically do you think needs review, and what do you think needs to be worked on, in finite terms?
Well, I do think that it's a very complex and very large treaty that we have, and now we're working together in another one that is also very complex. That is a famous TPP that is going on also. That's about trade, and I do think that we should see us as partners and to have like the same standards so that we can do better business with the rest of Asia. So I think that we have to see ourselves as a region. And as a region, we will be more competitive as a region with many nationalities, and celebrating that, because that makes us stronger. So I do think that we have to see us as partners and to have the same approach as a region towards other parts of the world.
When you say to see as partners, it sounds very much that you would like to see this be more equally viewed as partners, not necessarily one subordinate to another.
Yes, of course. I mean, we share a lot of things. We share beautiful and amazing things, a lot of cultural things. For example, in San Francisco, that is my jurisdiction, in San Francisco, we have every year the largest cultural festival in the U.S., and we use that to celebrate integration of the American and the Mexican cultures. For example, we did a big gala with American chefs doing Mexican tacos. Actually, they were good. And we did a lot of things like that. So we have a lot of things in common. We have fun together. We are partners. We do a lot of things. And in an economic basis, the NAFTA treaty, it's balanced. I mean, so I do think that we have to see ourselves as an integrated region, and sharing the Pacific, for example, and not as two countries are competing among themselves.
Consul General, do you consider NAFTA to be threatened at all? I mean, we don't know exactly how the TPP will play out, but with NAFTA, do you feel that there are any threats to that?
Well, there are a lot of things at stake over there. So I do think that NAFTA will be working very well. And those are it's very important because our numbers and it's economic and things, but more important, it's the people. It's the people that can feel that they are integrated to another country that they have chosen, and that they can feel comfortable, safe, with no fear, very proud of being part of the U.S. and of Mexico. So so we will work with the next president of the U.S., and we want to work to make the life of people that are living in the U.S. better, if they are Mexicans, Mexican-Americans, Hispanics, or Latinos.
Consul General, we have to go, but thank you so much for the time that you were able to give us today with your very busy schedule.
Thank you very much. What a pleasure.
The Consul General of Mexico, Jimmy Jose Gonzalez, is in Honolulu today to talk with St. Andrew School students later this morning. An author, political leader, and advisor, he was appointed to his San Francisco-based post earlier this year, and while here, he'll also be meeting with local lawmakers and congressional representatives.
helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Everybody in Hawaii knows about the late Senator Inouye. Most knew him as the senator that lost an arm during World War II and the man who won the Congressional Medal of Honor. He was a second lieutenant in the 442nd Infantry fighting in Italy. On April 21, 1945, Lieutenant Dan led his platoon through a wall of gunfire to within a few yards of the enemy when they were pinned down. To save the day, he climbed up a slope and tossed three grenades into the enemy position, destroying them. Then he stood up, took out another machine gun nest. And then he was hit by a grenade, but he was undaunted and charged on until the enemy surrendered. And we all know this cost him an arm. But this also was a great act of altruism. He passed on in 2012, but his philanthropy continues in the form of the Daniel K. Inouye Institute, which I'll tell you about on another episode. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
And at Hawaii Public Radio, philanthropy is especially all about you. And we'd like to say thanks to some sustaining members, because they're called sustaining members for a reason. These are the listeners who know that their monthly gifts mean a steady and predictable income for our station, one that allows this listener-supported operation to survive. Sustainers are a big part of the reason that HPR can provide two program streams all day, every day. Your pledge of $10 a month or more will keep your public radio station strong. We hope that you'll consider becoming an HPR sustainer and call us at 955-8821 or set up your monthly support at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
And to return to our backyard quiz, we're building bridges today. Specifically, we took a look at a historic bridge district on Hawaii Island that is home to 44 distinct spans. This impressive collection represents more than 100 years of construction and design, with the oldest span being designed in 1900 and the most recent, a partial renovation of an earlier bridge, completed in 2013. Almost every type of bridge you could think of is represented here, including timber stringer, masonry arch, concrete culvert, concrete T-beam, and the list goes on. If you wanted to test the structural integrity of these long-enduring feats of engineering, or just take in the view, start in Hilo on the Wailuku Stream Bridge No. 1 at the north end of town, then make your way to Honoka'a. On the way, you will encounter many of the 44 bridges that make up the old Mama Lahoa Highway Historic Bridge District.
And Ann Yaklovich called us from Honolulu and knew the answer, and will be receiving the HPR T-shirt. Thanks very much for joining us for the Backyard Quiz for today. And if you've got one for us for a future show, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
No one who lives in Hawaii needs to be reminded of the power of ocean waves, and we've been hearing about their potential as an alternative energy source for years. But they have yet to be harnessed on the kind of scale that would make them an effective source of electricity. That's changing, in part because of the research being done in Kaneohe Bay at the Hawaii Wave Energy Test Site, our WETS. Patrick Cross coordinates research at the site, and he joins us this morning. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Chris.
When you first hear about the potential of waves to produce electrical energy, one is tempted to think, okay, great, we'll just set it up so that the waves crank a generator and off we go. But there's perhaps a little more to it than that, yeah?
There's a little more to it, yes. It's a challenging problem. The reason wave energy has not become a key part of our renewable energy mix yet is because it's a hard problem. It's difficult to work in the ocean. Machines have to survive a corrosive environment and a potentially stormy, violent environment. Mm-hmm. So they've got to survive and they've got to produce electricity. that's economically competitive with other forms of renewable energy and ultimately with fossil fuels as well. And nobody's quite gotten there, but that's what we're working on.
The basic principle, though, is you're getting the waves to give something a push. I'm trying not to be too oversimplifying, but that can be converted to electrical energy.
Yes, yes. A wave energy conversion device, two of which are currently under test at our test site now, is basically something that is intended to get pushed around by the waves and to move, and then different types of conversion devices on those buoys or conversion devices convert that motion into electrical generation. So various companies around the world are coming up with very different approaches to how to do that, how to convert motion that's naturally there into electrical generation. So it remains to be seen what the winners will look like.
Well, the principle is sound and proven. It's a question of scale and what kind of device works best, yeah?
Yes, and I mean it's very unclear right now what the winners will look like. As I mentioned, it could be if you take a look at the two devices we have under test now, they look very different from each other, and they're using very different approaches to motion conversion into electricity. And if you look wider around the world where other concepts are being developed, you see there's no what we call convergence of the technology as yet. And that's where the test site comes in. We're the only test site in the U.S., one of just a few in the world. And so we're really gaining some key insights at this time to answer that question. Who's going to succeed?
Are you able to kind of assemble data that's being gathered at the other sites around the world?
Yes, actually, we have good relationships with the European Marine Energy Center, for example, in the Orkney Islands of Scotland, and a place called Wave Hub in the southern UK. And so, yes, we all kind of work together to share experiences and results.
We've seen a similar arc with wind energy, which at this point is well ahead of wave energy. Fair to say?
Fair to say.
What is it that has – what are the steps that have to be gone through to have wave energy catch up or at least go through that same cycle?
Right. We certainly have some hope that we can get through that cycle a little quicker than wind did, learning some lessons from that development. But really, I mean, there are different opinions to answer your question, but I think our take at WETS is we've got to get devices encouraging ideas into the water, into the real ocean, not just there's a progression to get to open ocean testing with tank testing and numerical modeling. But ultimately, you've got to get the thing in the real ocean and find out what breaks and figure out how to do it better. And so that's why we think that our test site here in Hawaii is a critical piece of the national and even the global approach to advancing wave energy.
Sure.
Yeah.
Once you get these devices, whatever they turn out to be, in the ocean, you're going to find some competition for that space, aren't you?
Certainly, yes. The area of what we call marine spatial planning is key to the future. As I mentioned, we've got lots of technological hurdles to overcome over the next few years, several years. But ultimately, if we can get encouraging results at the end of those several years, we're going to be looking at deploying wave energy in some scale in different parts of the world. And right, we'll have to compete with other uses of the ocean, such as fishing and tourism and boating and military uses and all of it. So that's going to be a key part of advancing wave energy.
And as I understand it, Patrick, one of the things that hasn't really been determined yet is how many devices, whatever those devices may be, let's see, there's a rough equivalent to a windmill, right? How many windmills or wave mills need to generate a meaningful amount of energy. That isn't really known yet, as I understand it.
No, it's not really known. It's modeled. We can look at numerical models and understand the wave environment and calculate how many devices you would need to have a competitive wave farm, as we call them. Mm-hmm. So far, we're only testing individual devices. But the road to the future is certainly in deployment of significant numbers of these devices so that you've got, say, half a megawatt to a megawatt individual devices times 15, 20, 100 devices to have.
Then that would start to make a difference.
That would start to make a difference.
Great. Well, we'll be hearing more about this because it's not going away, is it?
It's not going away. We'll be testing several more devices over the coming years, so stay tuned.
Terrific. We'll be keeping in touch. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Patrick Cross coordinates research at the Hawaii Wave Energy Test Site in Kaneohe Bay and provides site management assistance to U.S. Navy and Department of Energy sponsors. Wave energy is coming. We know that much, Bethann. It's really a question of economies of scale, exactly how that energy is converted to electricity. But there's no doubt that it's coming in some form.
And it's been coming for a while, and we've been having periodic conversations about it. Yeah. We're going to see how this conversation maybe moves into some greater reality.
It's pretty exciting, yeah.
Thanks very much for joining us today and all this week for the conversation. It's a Friday, so we're going to go away, but we'll be back with you on Monday, and we're going to take a look at the realities of the Point for Services to Children Rescued from Sex Trafficking.
And with storyteller Jeff Gear ventures into wordless communication.
That should be interesting. Now, we like to hear from you. Always interesting to hear from you, too. And you can call the talkback line anytime you like at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or say hello to me at BKOZHPR or find me on Instagram.
You can find the music you hear on our show on our page at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. And our executive producer is Bethann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants.
The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello, and I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Bethann Kozlovich. We'll see you on Monday when we pick up the conversation. Enjoy the weekend.